This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource of pilots and aircraft owners.
Hello everyone, this is Paul Bertarelli reporting for AdWeb. If you've been reading our news coverage, you've noticed that we've run a lot of stories about aviation developments in China, but like everyone else in the aviation press, we have a tough time tying it all together. In his new book, China Airborne, veteran journalist and pilot James Fallows has attempted to do just this, and he's joining us today for this podcast to talk about the book. Thanks for taking the time, Jim.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
One thing I'd like to ask about is an observation you make early in the book about a comment a foreigner living in China made, and I'll read the quote. "Each month I'm here, I know half as much as I did the month before." Now, the book has been off press for a while, and you've had time to think about your experience in China. Do you still have that feeling?
Yes, and I think this will sound contradictory, but I'm trying to say that it's worth Americans paying attention to China, since it's going to make so much difference in our aviation life and our economic life generally, environmental security. They should pay attention to it while realizing that things going on there are so contradictory and so complex that dealing with it is a matter of just getting used to confusion and knowing the things you don't know as well as the ones you do.
You mentioned that later. Speaking of contradictory, you mentioned that in a sense, it's not one China, which I think in the U.S. we tend to think that it is, but it's dozens, if not hundreds, of Chinas. Has it always been that way, or is this a function of modernization?
I think, you know, the scale of China has always been huge. It's always been, through most of recorded history, the most populous nation on Earth. But certainly, if you look back 30 or 40 years ago and you see pictures of the Cultural Revolution era, Mao was really able to put his stamp over the entire country. But now, I think most people who travel around China feel that it is, strangely and almost incredibly, a more diverse place than the United States is. You have hyper-modern areas, and you have people who are billionaires, and you have people who might as well be living in the 1400s in terms of no electricity and no running water and slaughtering any food that they need to eat. The geographical extent of the country is almost like that of the United States. The range of people is not quite the same as our racial diversity, but it is at least comparable in terms of regional differences and all the rest. And so I think the picture many people have of the Beijing Olympics opening ceremony with one gigantic unified mass of people really is a miscue to what a varied, mosaic-like carnival of different activities it is.
One thing that people who haven't been to China may find is that it does have this contradictory, diverse character to it. How is that going to work for any kind of a unified aviation system? Can it work?
The question you asked is one of the reasons I wanted to tell my story of China, where I've lived most of the last 6 years, through the aviation angle, because I think it's a particularly acute way to see all the different tensions in China now. Certainly, the Chinese government views expanding its air travel network as being a really important way to unify the country, to serve some of the same functions the railroads did in the 19th century and aviation over the last century for the United States. And that means applying, obviously, some national standards for air safety and procedures and all of that. But still, you have, in all these different corners of the country, you have mayors of small cities, that's, say, between 3 million and, say, 6 million, provincial governors who think that they're going to be the ones to have the new aerotropolis that will be the center of China's aviation industries. So I describe in the book going to these places that are the equivalent of some rural area of Nebraska, and you see this huge new airstrip comparable, say, to DFW complex with no visible civilization around it. And there's this disconnected activity of trying to generate things all over the country combined with central national efforts to build an aircraft industry, to have better safety standards, and all the rest that has to be done on a national level.
You described the big installation in one of the western provinces that they built, assuming with no market studies or any kind of sense of what would develop, they constructed a huge, new, sophisticated airport that was basically empty, assuming that the aircraft and the activity would come, and has it or will it come?
It hasn't come yet, and whether it will come is part of the bet that this part of Shaanxi province, which is near, it's the nearest big city is Xi'an, which most people will have heard of for these famous terracotta warriors that were there. And Xi'an is a big, sort of the equivalent of Wichita being a big aerospace center for China. Things haven't happened there yet, but the drama that China as a whole is trying to accomplish here is they recognize they've been successful for 30 years in building these factories with low wage component work, but they really want to have the higher end industries like what the U.S. has with aerospace. So this place outside Xi'an was trying to say, well, if we have all these facilities, maybe this will become an air travel center. Maybe this will become a new research center. They're also working against the military controls on aerospace, which is a whole different subject.
They're really practicing build it and they will come, are they not?
They are, and I think that's a crucial point about Chinese development in general, that almost everything about the country's growth in the last 10 years has been based on building something, building factories, building roads, building new cities that could hold millions of people in the remote areas. And the airport building boom, where there's about 100 new major airports under construction right now, a fact to reflect upon for all of our listeners, comparing it with the U.S. This is also, build it and they will come, as it might be the motto of modern China.
And related to that, when we were reporting on the Cirrus buy, we were obviously doing it from a distance, and we could never figure out why the Chinese picked Cirrus and if it made any sense. But you report that aviation generally is part of China's 12th five-year plan, so that didn't apply specifically to Cirrus, but Cirrus sort of fit into the mold for that. In retrospect, does the Cirrus buy still make sense, or did it make sense at all?
I think there are specifics of this deal which are being worked out still between the General Aviation Group in China and Cirrus and the world market, which are still not certain. But there, from the Chinese point of view, there was a kind of logic to this. As you say, the current five-year plan, the 12th five-year plan, sounds preposterous to us, but it really is important in Chinese guidance, is to push really hard in what they view as strategic high-value industries of the future, including aerospace and clean energy and pharma and genomics and things like that. So there was this national drive to move wherever they could in the aerospace sector. And then, and so they're building, trying to build a new large aircraft and looking for being involved in Embraer and the rest. Then there was a sort of opportunistic local aspect where people down in southern China thought, gee, we have this huge airport in Zhuhai, which nobody uses. Maybe this could become our new aerospace center. So it was both combination of national plan and local promoters slash hucksters. So that's how it came about, and I guess we all hope it works.
In the larger context, you quote one Chinese official as saying, you can't imagine how big this is going to be, and he was referring to developments in aviation and aerospace. From your perspective, is that a fair comment?
This was a really interesting guy whose whole story I won't tell, but he lived in America. He was grew up in Shanghai. He went to America and made his fortune and came back with the belief that aerospace would be one of the ways that he could transform China and make his own personal fortune. And the point he made is that if he was talking to Americans 15 years ago about the cell phone market in China, they'd say, well, this country is too poor. And now, of course, it's by far the world's leading markets for cell phones. And he says that the untapped potential for helicopters and for business jets and for large aircraft is so large there that if they can find ways to get it going, it will have the same potential as cars and cell phones and all the rest. So I guess in any entrepreneurial activity, you need people like that with that spirit. And there are a lot of metrics that would support his hopefulness.
And one of those has to be access to airspace. We've read about the restricted airspace. The military is hanging on to it. Are they going to let go of the airspace? Is it happening?
It is being contested right now. And maybe this is one of the really important things to explain to listeners who haven't spent time in China. We all know from a North American airspace chart that the majority of it is uncontrolled, and there are, you know, certain areas for military activities or whatever. In China, it's almost all still military controlled. Their modern airspace tradition is all military first and other things second. And the military stands for the security forces in general in China, which resist any kind of loosening up of things. On the other hand, are all the economic forces that think they can make good business deals if they have freer travel. And so every single week that's being contested, a lot of U.S. officials and individuals have played a crucial role in dealing with these economic modernizers inside China to try to loosen it up. And the faster it loosens, the faster the industry will grow. But that is just every single day there's a new front in that struggle.
And by your reporting, it seems like the Chinese are receptive to these Western efforts.
It's amazing how big a difference both in the aerospace field and other aspects of China in terms of higher education or whatever, foreigners, largely Americans, how much difference they've made by just deciding that they were going to inject themselves in the system and try to change it. I won't go into all the details now, but as you know, I tell the story of a Boeing engineer named Joe T, who with some of his colleagues has made a huge difference in transforming Chinese airlines from some of the most dangerous in the world to some of the safest in the world. And there has been a lot of receptivity to this from the Chinese officials and individuals as long as it's done in a face-saving way, mm-hmm. especially when the Americans say these are international standards we're talking about, not telling you to learn from the U.S.
The so-called change with Chinese character or Chinese characteristics.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there is a natural and proper pride by Chinese people in what the country has done in the last 30 years. And so most of the Americans who spend time there learn how to acknowledge that and then still work for better conditions.
Now, you did manage to fly a few light aircraft trips in China in Cirrus aircraft, the first one, which sounded quite harrowing. Would that be easier to do today?
Yes. This flight I described in the beginning of my book was 6 years ago, and that was one which had everything going against it, from having to siphon the avgas out of old Russian trainer planes to not being able to reach the controller as we neared the mountains and all the rest. In the 6 years since then, several things have made it easier to do a general aviation flight inside China. One is the pre-notification period for a flight plan to be improved has gone down from a couple of weeks to a couple of hours. Imagine if you had to file a couple of week pre-clearance for a flight plan. So that has improved. The number of airports and the related facilities is also expanding. And the very modern navigation is being brought in, that a lot of the sort of precision navigation that we know about from Alaska and elsewhere is being installed in remote Chinese areas. So it's better than it was 6 years ago with that flight I described.
Last question on the commercial aviation side. You observe that China believes if it can do aerospace well, it can do about anything. From what you know now in a perspective of a few years, do you think it can succeed in the manufacture of its regional jet and its transport jet and be a player in the world market?
I guess I'd make 2 points. One is it's going to take a while, and even the Chinese officials recognize that. This is a very slow infrastructure to build up, so I think there is not an enormous immediate presence the Chinese regional and big jets are going to make. But the larger point that I think is understood by the Chinese officials and I try to explain in the book is that this is a kind of proxy for their ability to modernize in general, and a kind of Chinese system that was a world leader in aerospace would have changed in ways that are beneficial for the world in general. It would have to have loosened up in censorship and in freedom of research and interaction with international standards. So in a way, we should hope that they become world competitors in this field, because that would suggest the country as a whole has evolved in a way that makes it easier for the world to deal with them.
So does that represent for the West a threat or an opportunity or both?
It's both. And I think Boeing, Airbus, Embraer, GE, Pratt & Whitney, Rolls-Royce, Honeywell, any other component maker or large airspace firm you can think of views China simultaneously as a threat and opportunity. It's an opportunity because so much of the growth in the world's market is going to be there. You know, if you're involved in designing airports, that's where basically all the airports in the world are being built right now. The threat is in the long run. Obviously, the Chinese want to have their own counterparts to these industries and not be dependent on the West. So it's a matter of It's a year of living dangerously or decade of living dangerously type proposition of being involved there enough to take advantage of the opportunity, but being aware enough to avoid the threats.
Well, for all those Boeing and Airbus executives, I recommend that they get a copy of your book and take a look. There's a lot of interesting information in there. It's a good analysis, and I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us today, Jim.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate having this opportunity.
This is Paul Bertarelli reporting for AvWeb. We've been speaking with author Jim Fallows, and the name of his book is China Airborne. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine. For more information on Aviation Consumer, log on to www.aviationconsumer.com.